Good evening, everyone, and welcome. It's my great honor to introduce my Rebbe of Rabbonus, my dear colleague, teacher, and friend, Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter. I stand here representing not only myself, but my colleague who is here, and teacher and friend, Rabbi Gershon Siegel from Congregation Bethel at Eretz Israel. We welcome all of the members of Congregation Bethel who are co-sponsoring this evening together with us here at Shaarei Tefila and the Center for the Jewish Future of my alma mater, Yeshiva University. 41 rabbis have converged from all over the United States for the once-a-year opportunity to study with our mutual Rebbe, Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter. It's really a testament to who he is as a person, as a Jew, as a Rav, as a rabbi's rabbi, as a teacher, that year to year, wherever the Center for the Jewish Future announces the Yarche Kala, the annual conclave of rabbis, we will go by bus, by train, by automobile, by airplane, by foot, any way we can arrive at the desk of Rabbi Schachter is certainly a privilege. People here, of course, are familiar with our teacher friend, Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter. Before he became university professor at Yeshiva University and before he became the resident scholar for the Center for the Jewish Future, he was the dean of the Rabbi Soloveitchik Institute here at Maimonides School. Before that, he was the rabbi of the Jewish Center in Manhattan for many years. He's a noted lecturer, author, prolific author, I should say, and really has so many talmidim through the wonders of the internet, through in-person visits, through his writings, all over the United States, and certainly we have the great privilege to study with him today. I would just add a couple of personal words. Some of you may know, some of you may not know. I had the opportunity to serve first as a rabbinic intern and then as the assistant rabbi to Rabbi Schachter in 2 years. I very much feel shali, shalcha harav Schachter, anything that I've accomplished in my rabbonus, and I hope I've made some type of positive contribution. Any of the positive contributions I've made, I credit my dear teacher. Any of the mistakes and errors I made, I totally own by myself. And it's just a great honor in our new shul here at Shaarei Tefila to have Rabbi Schachter. When I first came to Shaarei Tefila, Rabbi Schachter was kind enough to come up and to speak in honor of my beginning my position here at Shaarei Tefila, and here in another slightly different way. We're not quite inaugurating this space, but it certainly feels like that to me. So welcome, Rabbi Umori, and welcome one and all.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Rabbi Samuels, for that wonderful introduction. It's really a tremendous pleasure and a tremendous privilege to be back again and to be back in Newton, in Brookline, in the Boston area, and in particular to be here in this space and in this shul. Rabbi Samuels and I know one another. He mentioned in passing that he was together with me at the Jewish Center. It was in 1994 and 1995. So it's been a while already that we know one another. And what I would like to mention in that context is that I had the privilege in 1995 of getting a sabbatical from my shul in the Jewish Center. Rabbi Samuels was my assistant rabbi at the time. And I left for 6 months. I left the shul for 6 months. I actually came to Harvard. I had a fellowship at Harvard for 6 months. And I left my entire congregation in the hands of Rabbi Samuels. So this was a major shul, Upper West Side of Manhattan, many hundreds of members. And I felt comfortable leaving, knowing that everything would be taken care of. And so Rabbi Samuels has demonstrated extraordinary rabbinic leadership already at a very young age, which has only continued to grow as he now celebrates, he tells me, 17 years in Shaarei Tefila. and particularly to come to this space. Rabbi Samuels mentioned that our group has decided this year to come here in order to celebrate the wonderful achievement of Rabbi Samuels and of Rabbi Siegel. What an amazing set of brachos for two great synagogues to be able to engage in such substantial, significant, meaningful building expansions, and to represent not only the vibrancy of this great Newton community, but I think the vibrancy of American Orthodoxy, when Orthodox synagogues can present such a beautiful vision of traditional Judaism through such extraordinary rabbis and such extraordinary lay leaders that bless both of these very exceptional congregations. So we brought 40 rabbis to come here to shep nachas from our chaverim and to give chizuk to our chaverim and to be inspired by the extraordinary work of Rabbi Samuels and of Rabbi Siegel. And I'm honored to acknowledge the presence of Rabbi Siegel this evening as well. We are grateful for the hospitality that we've experienced in the Newton community since we came yesterday afternoon. And I also want to thank the Jacobsons, Sharon and Joe, for hosting all the rabbis at home last night and for being so kind and being so gracious to us. It's also very special to see in the audience a number of old friends, warm, close friends for so many years, and to be able to reconnect with you. I hope we'll catch a few minutes with one another after the presentation, and to express to you the high regard that we have for you and for your community and for this shul and for Beth El Ateret Israel, where we were studying today. A number of our rabbis are in the midst of trying to reconfigure their own sanctuaries, and we're very much taken by the originality and the creativity and the sensitivity that was expressed here and in Bethel, and learned a great deal. So I'm sure you know you should be very proud of what you have accomplished as a larger community, as a synagogue community. It's kol hakavod to you, and it's really thrilling to be here to be able to celebrate with you this evening. The subject that I'd like to share is Me'inyana d'Yom. It has to do with what's going on at the time now. And I don't want you to get nervous from all the Hebrew on the sheets. I will translate everything. I'll summarize most of the things. I won't read inside, maybe a little bit just to get a sense. But I want to reflect a little bit about the times that we live in and to try to make a case that what started a very long time ago in what we would call ancient Jewish history is something that's reflected in modern Jewish history. And that there is a continuity here in our tradition that binds the past to the present. And that we live our lives as Jews, as engaged Jews, and as thoughtful Jews. We live our lives trying to figure out a way how to negotiate the transition from the past to the present, and to make the present meaningful based on criteria, based on concepts that we have from the past. That the past doesn't just remain in the past. It's not something that happened. There's a Talmudic phrase, "Mai dahava hava," what happened, happened. But we understand very well that we stand on the shoulders of giants, and that we understand that we live basing our contemporary understanding of Jewish values and of Jewish living on certain fundamental principles and realities that we take with us from the past. So if you were to ask the question, we're now in the time between Pesach and Shavuot. It's known as the time of Sfira, the time of Sfirat HaOmer. We count the Omer every night, beginning the second night of Pesach, all the way until Shavuot. I'm not going to say what tonight is, because I didn't count it yet. So whatever tonight is, tonight is. And it will be one more tomorrow night, and until we come to the holiday of Shavuot. Now, we have a tradition that during this time, between Pesach and Shavuot, it's not only a time of counting the Omer, which is biblical in origin, but it's also a time of mourning. So we don't have weddings generally during this time. We curtail a sense of joy and happiness during this time. There are certain expressions of less than a full-throated happiness of life, whether it's a communal issue or whether it is a personal matter. And the general association with that comes from a Talmudic passage on page 1, where the Talmud tells us that this is the time exactly when there was a terrible tragedy that happened to the students of Rabbi Akiva. And the students of Rabbi Akiva, the great Rabbi Akiva, one of the great rabbinic luminaries of all time, he had 12,000 students, or some say he had 12,000 pairs of students. And for some reason, they didn't get along with one another, and there was inappropriate behavior and things that should not have happened. And it turns out that all of them passed away. And they all died between Pesach and Shavuot. So dafka this time of year, when we're counting the Omer from Pesach to Shavuot, so the Omer is not just the Omer, not just the counting of the Omer. The Omer is a offering that was brought in the temple. It's not just that. But it turns out that it has a practical considerations for us in that it, in a sense, impinges upon the fullness of the joy that we might otherwise want to express. And the most practical example of this is that we don't have any weddings, some till Rosh Chodesh, after Rosh Chodesh, till Omos Shavuos, till Lag BaOmer, after Lag BaOmer, and we'll actually come to that distinction in a moment. Now, it turns out that if we fast forward 1,000 years, if we fast forward 1 millennium from the time of Rabbi Akiva, we find ourselves in northwestern Germany in the 11th century. And what I want to do is I want to take this time frame and to trace it historically and to draw some practical and conceptual conclusions or considerations from this. So in the year 1095, the Pope at that time, Pope Urban II, makes an announcement in Clermont. Clermont is a town in southern France, that it is time to recapture the holy city from the infidels. We're now in 1095. The infidels, who have control over the holy city since the middle of the 7th century, are the Muslims. And for all kinds of reasons, the church decides it's a bazillion, it's a shanda, it's an embarrassment that the Muslims have control over the holy city of Jerusalem. After all, the holy city of Jerusalem is a city where Jesus, who's the founder of Christianity, taught and ministered and served as a role model, and even more significant, was crucified, and even more significant than that, was resurrected. So the city of Jerusalem is a very holy place for Christians, and what a shame it is for our religion that another religion, a competing religion, has control over this city. We should regain the control over the city that we had before the Muslims came. And so he calls for a crusade. The crusade leaves from southern France. Now we have a letter. We have a very interesting letter. We actually don't have the letter. We have the answer to the letter. There's a letter that was sent from the French communities to the German communities. The French Jewish community was panic-stricken when the Pope announces this crusade because they thought, quite plausibly, that they would be victims, that once the fervor of the church is stirred up against infidels, so why do we need to go all the way for 3 years to Jerusalem to find infidels if by me in the backyard I have infidels, and not just stam infidels, but I have Christ-killing infidels. I have deicide infidels. I have those who are responsible for the killing of the Lord. So if I'm already on a roll against the infidels, I could be mekayim the mitzvah of harigas infidels right here, and why do I have to wait until... It took them 3 years until 1099 until they got, in fact, as they did get to Jerusalem and, in fact, succeeded in conquering Jerusalem from the Muslims. So the French Jewish community is panic-stricken. They send the letter to the German Jewish community. We don't have that letter. We have the answer. The answer is, dear French Jews, we are in receipt of your letter. We understand the terrible concern that you have. We really feel terrible for you. Enclosed, find money that you could use to bribe whatever officials you need to bribe to try to protect yourself. And you should know that we also established a fast day for a half a day, that we are engaged in prayer and supplication for God for compassion and mercy on you. And we're doing whatever we can to help you. We feel for you. We empathize with you. We identify with you. But you should know that we in Germany are not really worried about this because we have wonderful relations with the leading authorities. So therefore, we're not really worried about ourselves, but Kol Yisrael Chaverim, we love each other, we're all our Ravim, Ze La Ze, and so we'll do whatever we can for you. Sincerely, your signed German Jewry. Turns out, in 1096, in the spring of 1096, that German Jewry gets pretty much decimated. In particular, the northwestern communities along the Rhine River of Speyer, Worms, and Mainz. Speyer, Worms, and Mainz actually going south to north. Speyer, an hour, 50 minutes by car, by bus, north. Worms, 50 minutes, an hour, north to Mainz. They get destroyed. German Jewry gets smashed. French Jewry essentially emerges unscathed in the First Crusade. So in a sense, to borrow from a Purim terminology, it's vanahafochu. French Jews who were so panic-stricken, relatively okay. German Jews, and I'm going to just say this again, German Jews who said, it cannot happen here. German Jews who said, we're so rooted in this country that it will not happen here, were the ones who bore the full brunt of the wrath of the Crusades on their way to the Holy Land. Now, when did the Crusades decimate German Jewry in 1096? Precisely when, and we know exactly when. We, in fact, know very exactly when. There are three or four major Crusade chronicles that made their way in manuscript until the 19th century when they were published that describe chapter and verse, day, month, number of Jews who were killed. The day they were killed, the month they were killed, and the number of Jews that were killed in Speyer and Worms and Mainz. Now this gets distilled in one of the keynotes that are recited on Tisha B'Av. On the 9th of Av, there are four paragraphs, four keynotes that we recite that deal with the Crusades. And one of them is explicitly and actually atypically historical. Most of the time, a kina is more of a poetic lament for what was lost in a generic, general kind of a way. They generally are not historically focused. They're generally not telling us an exact story. Oh, how sad it is. The Torah is girded in sackcloth. Who will teach us what will be? How will we ever continue? How can we appreciate God in the face of such a tremendous challenge? We, God, will continue to express our fealty to you no matter what happens to us. And these are very gripping, and they're very sensitive, and they're very powerful, but they're not historical. One of them, atypically, is historical. And on page 2, I Xeroxed from a passage of one of them, and I'll show you in the underlined lines exactly the dates and months when this devastation of German Jewry took place. So we start with Haruge Ashpira. If you turn the page sideways, Haruge Ashpira Speyer. Remember, we're going south to north. The Jews of Speyer were killed Basheni Bishmona Bo. What is Basheni? What is Bachodesh Arishon? Achodesh Hazeh Lochem Rosh Chodeshim is Nisan. So Bachodesh Hasheni is the month of Iyar. Bishmona Bo, on the 8th day of the second month. So what's today? Today, when was Rosh Chodesh? Rosh Chodesh was Monday, Sunday, and Monday. So right, Sunday and Monday. So Monday is day 1, Tuesday, I'm not counting the Omer. Tuesday is day 2, tomorrow is day 3. On the 8th day, in 5 days from now, is the anniversary in 1096 of the destruction of Speyer Jews, Haruge Ashpaira, Basheni Chodesh Iyar on the eighth day, and it happened to be Biyom Margoa. What is Margoa? Margoa means a rest or relaxation. So it happened to be on a Shabbos. The eighth day of Iyar in 1096 was on a Shabbos, and that's when Speyer was destroyed. Skip a couple of lines. Underline Kahal Vermeiza. Vermeiza is worms. We're now moving south to north. Pa'amayim kitchu shem ha-miyuchad b'mora. The worms, Jewish community, was twice the victim of a pogrom. Be'esrim u'shlosha b'chodesh ziv l'tahara. Chodesh ziv is a biblical way of referring to Chodesh Iyar, this month. So it took them from the 8th of Iyar to the 23rd to traverse that 50-minute car ride to go from Speyer to Worms and to wreak havoc in the Worms Jewish community on the 23rd. And again, Ubachodesh Hashlishi in the third month. What's the third month? Nisan Iyar Sivan. Ubachodesh Hashlishi Bikrias Halel Lishorara, on a time when Halel is recited. Now, before you tell me when it is, I'm going to ask you, when do you think it could be? Because, why am I asking you? Because we have two options. It could be Rosh Chodesh, and it could be Shavuot. Answer, from here we don't know, but the Crusade Chronicles tell us explicitly, and we're going to come to this a little bit later from other sources, that it's clearly a reference to Rosh Chodesh. That it was on the first day of the month of Sivan, and we'll soon see that it has to be that, even from an internal analysis of this text itself. So what happens is Worms is now destroyed twice, 23rd of Iyar, first day of Sivan. Now we continue a little bit further. Ba Chodesh Hashlishi Bishlishi, on the third month, on the third day of the month. And then, in the next line, which I regretfully and apparently prematurely cut off, it talks about Magenza. Speyer Vermeiza Magenza. Magenza was destroyed on the third day of the third month. So now, let's just stop for a second and think about what has just transpired. That this same time of the year, between Pesach and Shavuot, which entered into the Jewish calendar is a sad time because of the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, which the Talmud on page 1 explicitly identifies as having died during this time. Lo and behold, fast forward 1,000 years, in 1096, the bastion of Ashkenazi Jewry at that time, there was already a very substantial, significant, flourishing Jewish community in Spain at that time that was unaffected. The Ashkenazi Jewish community is France, Germany, and England, but primarily Germany, and primarily in these three communities that actually have an acronym in our tradition. They're known as Kehilot, Shin, Vav, Mem, Speyer, Ver, Meiza, Magenza, Kehilot, Shum. They have a quasi kind of a super communal identity that they are part of a larger confederation of communities. It's not just each one making yomtiv for themselves, but they're part of a larger group, Kehilot Shum. They get destroyed, Dafka, during this time between Pesach and Shavuot. Once again, Speyer on the 8th of Iyar, Worms on the 23rd of Iyar, and on the 1st of Sivan, and Mainz on the 3rd day of Sivan. You can go to Germany today, and I would imagine some of you have been to Germany and maybe even have traveled to these cities. I was there already a few times. And you can go to the community of Speyer. There are nothing left in Speyer. There's one old mikveh that is identified as being from the 14th century, which is quite extraordinary. You have to get the key from the right guy and open it up and go down. And it's amazing. It's like a well in the middle of the city in a basement behind a house. That's all that's left that is even remotely identified with the Jewish life, Speyer. Worms is very, very profoundly rich in Jewish artifacts or Jewish material. There's an amazingly significant and important cemetery in Worms that I still, ad hayom hazeh, don't understand why it had remained absolutely untouched under the Nazis. It looks exactly the way it looked in 1900 and in 1800 and in 1700 and in 1600. The cemetery in Worms, the most famous person buried in the cemetery in Worms is Reb Meir of Rothenburg. The Maharami Rutenberg is buried in Worms. He's buried right next to, you know, there's a very famous story. He was in captivity and Jews wanted to ransom him and he didn't want them to ransom him. So he died in captivity, and then Reb Avram Wimpfman said that he would donate the money and ransom the body on the condition that he would be buried next to Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg. And in fact, he's buried right next to Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg. It looks almost like, this is really modern, this is magnificent, but in like the old kind of shuls where they had like the Aseres HaDibros on top of the Aron Kodesh. This is extraordinarily beautiful. The old style. That's what it looks like. It looks like it's almost one tombstone with a little split down the middle in Worms. And there are many other great rabbis who are buried in Worms. And there's also a shul in Worms. It's known as the Rashi Shul. So when I went to the Rashi Shul for the first time, I was leading a group of American Jews, and I'm teaching them Jewish history. We come into the Rashi Shul, and there's a local guide, and it's a very small shul, and there's a seat in front of the shul, and the guide says, Rashi sat in that shul, in that chair. So I looked at the chair, and I looked at the guide, and I took off my yarmulke. Don't take a picture of this, please, Rabbi Samuels. I took off my yarmulke, and I said to him, if Rashi sat on that chair, Beli Neder, I'm going to eat my yarmulke. That's what I said to him. Because it's, you know, we're talking 800 years. You know, this is like a piece of time. And Rashi spent 3 years. And that's so amazing about the power of Rashi, that a place that he's studied in for 3 years, Rashi's a Frenchman. He comes to this part of the world maybe for 6 or 7 or 8 years, and he divides his time between Worms and Mainz, both of which had yeshivas. So when he's in Worms for 3 years, that it's known as the Rashi Shul. Just parenthetically, if you go to Newport, Rhode Island, and Professor Sarna is here, you go to Newport, where I'm to the Touro Synagogue, and I was there too, and there they'll say, George Washington, you know, he put his Altmeron Schulding right on that chair, and that I'm ready to, you know, I mean, that could be, you know, like I wasn't, you know, I didn't take off my yarmulke when Rabbi Mel Itzkowitz, who's now finishing his term as a rabbi of the Touro Synagogue, told me that George Washington, you know, the famous letter, that George Washington, not just the letter, but he mamashi b'chvoidoyu ba'atzmeitzu ha'degezex, on that chair, that I was prepared to be makabel, but that Rashi said on that chair, that's Worms. You go a little bit further, Speyer, Worms, Mainz. Mainz has a very old cemetery. All that's left in Mainz is a very old cemetery, and there's actually a tombstone, Reish Gimel Mem Hei with two streichelach. Reish Gimel Mem Hei, Rabbeinu Gershom, Maor HaGola. There's a tombstone. Looks old to me. What do I know? I'm not an expert. But the tradition tells us that Rabbeinu Gershom was buried there or near there or around there or in that area. All of these communities are destroyed between Pesach and Shavuos. And what are the implications of that, and what difference does it make? So if you turn to the bottom of page 2, we have something really fascinating. So some of you may be familiar with the fact that there are different minhagim when it comes to Avelus and Sfira. There are different practices. So the Mechaber, Rav Yosef Karo, you see right at the top, he talks about Talmidei Rabbi Akiva. He immediately acknowledges that the driving force behind the mourning during this time of the year of the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, and in Se'if Beis, 3 lines down, Noagim Shelo Lehistaper Ad Lag Laomer. He's talking here about cutting one's hair, so we have a custom that we don't take haircuts during this time, until Lag Baomer, Sha'omrim Sha'az Paskum Ilamas. That even though the Gemara says, and we saw the Gemara, Tana v'chula mesumi Pesach v'ad atzeres. So there are sources, medieval sources, that indicate that it wasn't really mamish all the way till atzeres. It was till pros atzeres. It was till 15 days before atzeres. And so they stopped dying at Lag BaOmer, which means that until Lag BaOmer mourning, now I don't have to mourn anymore because we're not commemorating any of their deaths. Next halacha, Seif Gimel. Yesh nagim lehistaper barosh chodesh iyar v'toos hu biyada. Some people have a custom this past Sunday and Monday to take a haircut. It's a mistake. Rosh Chodesh is not any reason to justify taking a haircut because they were dying then also. They died straight from Pesach until Lag BaOmer. Now in the tiny, tiny, tiny print, which I apologize for, which I need to take off my glasses for, but which I will translate for you. So what follows is no longer the big block letters of Rabbi Yosef Karo the Sephardi. What follows are the Rashi, so-called, speaking of Rashi, Rashi print from Rav Moshe Isserles the Ashkenazi. Mihu, Baharbe mekomos noagem lehistaper ad rosh chodesh iyor, va'osan lo yistapru milag ba'omer ve'elach. There are, however, communities, he says, that you don't start from Pesach and stop at Lag BaOmer. You start from Rosh Chodesh Iyar, and you end all the way almost until Shavuot. So we have the sort of Sephardi custom identified here, Pesach Lag BaOmer, the Ashkenazi custom, Rosh Chodesh Iyar, until almost Shavuot, which means until Rosh Chodesh Iyar. According to this, you can have a wedding, you can take a haircut, there's no reason to have any mourning period. And the question is, why? What is the basis for Rabbi Isserles' position? Rabbi Isserles was a rabbi in Krakow. He's buried in Krakow. So I have all kinds of ambivalence about visiting Poland, but I think once in your life, I would say you must go to Poland. Poland is one big kever avos. And to go to Krakow, and to go to the cemetery in Krakow, where Rav Moshe Isserles is buried, and to go to the shul in front of the cemetery in Krakow, which is known as the Ramah Shul, just like you have the Rashi Shul in Worms, you have the Ramah Shul in Krakow. By the way, if you go to Krakow and you go to the cemetery, there's something that always interested me that I'll share with you, so maybe it'll be meaningful to you when you go, but it also upset me. There, right behind the shul, you have Rav Moshe Isserles' matseva. It's huge. It's magnificent. It has 25 lines on it, and it's poetic, and it's gorgeous. Right next to it, there's a big, huge stone that has the following. Pei Nun, here lies Miriam Achot Moshe. That's it. So Rav Moshe Isserles apparently had a sister, and her name was Miriam. And the whole thing is, I'm sure she was an extraordinary woman in her own right, Miriam Achot Moshe. So you understand, of course, the biblical connection, Miriam Achot Moshe. So on the one hand, it's like sweet and fuzzy and warm in the hearts. And on the other hand, it's a shtickle, she must have been a somebody, that her whole identity, Ladore Dore Dore Doros, is Miriam Achot Moshe. So on the one hand, the first time I saw it, I was like taken by it, and then I started to get, like, I'm a father of daughters, you know what I mean? Like this just didn't sit right with me. Anyway, so the question is, where does Rav Moshe Isserles, Krakow, Krakow is Ashkenaz, Jews from Germany made their way to Poland, how does this happen that there's another minhag from Rosh Chodesh Iyar until almost Shavuos? Says the Hele Gittaz, on the bottom right-hand side, the Taz, whose name was Rav David Halevi, who lived in the 17th century in Eastern Europe, he wrote a sefer called Turei Zahav, a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. The Taz says, I'll tell you where Rabbi Isserles is coming from, and now you know where Rabbi Isserles is coming from. Rabbi Isserles is absolutely not coming from Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Isserles absolutely is coming from where? From the Crusades. When were the Jews killed during the time of the Crusades? From the 8th of Iyar until the 3rd of Sivan. It's precisely then that Rabbi Isserles identifies as the time of mourning. So what's happening now is that a historical event is impinging upon a ritual practice. That until then, and after then, in the Sephardi world, where the Crusades was not a significant player, it's all about Rabbi Akiva. In Ashkenaz, after the Crusades eclipse Rabbi Akiva, And when now determining and defining the time of mourning, based not on the Talmudic story about the students of Rabbi Akiva, but he says on the story of the Crusades. If you look on page 3, so whether it's Rabbi Yaakov Emden in the 18th century, whether it's the Aruch HaShulchan at the end of the 19th century, these are formidable rabbinic scholars who, when they talk about the period of mourning now we are already into the month of Iyar, and we're moving towards Shavuot, make reference not only to Rabbi Akiva, but also acknowledge the fact that there were all these other events that happened a millennium after Rabbi Akiva that also need to be factored into account, particularly in the Ashkenazi community, to explain the behavior of the mourning period during this time. Now, next step. The bottom of page 3, the kina that I xeroxed for you earlier that describes the different days on which the Jewish communities were killed during the time of the Crusades asks a question. And the question that it asks is, and this is something that I taught for the 5 years that I had the privilege of being at the Rabbi Soloveitchik Institute in the 70s and in the early 80s that I had the privilege of hearing from Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik himself in the Maimonides School on Tisha B'Av. He would make the following point. The kina asks, if I just told you when these atrocities or tragedies occurred, I just now told you 6 lines ago, so why am I mentioning it today? Today, what is today? Today is Tisha B'Av. Why am I mentioning it on Tisha B'Av? I just told you it didn't happen on Tisha B'Av. I just told you it happened when? 8th Iyar, 23rd Iyar, 1st Sivan, 3rd Sivan. So why am I talking about it today? Answer, today, Tisha B'Av, is the day on which we subsume all Jewish tragedies. That we don't set up a particular fast day for this purpose. We don't set up a fast day to remember the Crusades, because we don't do that. In Lahosif, bottom of page 3, Moed Sheva V'Savera, Alkein Hayom Livyasi A'orara, I'm going to do it today on Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is a day that's designated to commemorate all of Jewish tragedy. And then, just parenthetically, Rabbi Soloveitchik would then invariably, never failed every single year, say, therefore I am opposed, and this is relevant to last week, I am opposed to Yom HaShoah. I am opposed to Yom HaShoah. There should not be a separate day to commemorate the Holocaust. Yom HaShoah belongs on Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is a day to set aside to commemorate all Jewish tragedy, and the precedent for the rejection of a separate day for the Holocaust comes from this kina, which states a rejection of a separate day for the Crusades. Now that itself is a whole mouthful that requires all kinds of an analysis, which I'm just showing you is how powerful this statement is. We don't have any fast days when it comes to the Crusades. However, page 4, I will show you, and I'll show it to you only very briefly, and you can take it home and look at it yourself. That's not really true. Because in fact, page 4 has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 sources that say that in Worms they fasted on Rosh Chodesh Sivan. And I'm going to say that again because it sounds a little bit odd. Because in our tradition, Rosh Chodesh is generally not a day for fasting. You don't establish a fast day on a Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh, we say Hallel, it's a happy time. It's a quasi-festival, whatever that means exactly. We don't have a fast day on Rosh Chodesh. And that's, I think, precisely why we know about it, because it sort of piqued the curiosity of rabbinic decisors who began to question, you know, like, wow, this is a little bit odd. It wasn't a whole day. It wasn't a whole day. It was only half a day. And then they davened mincha, and then they went to eat. But already in the 13th century, we have evidence, and it goes all the way through the Mishnah Brura in the bottom left, which is into the 20th century. Quotes from the Magen Avraham, which is in the 17th century, based on the Chavos Yar, which is at the turn of the 18th century, all the way back, then in Worms they actually fasted on Rosh Chodesh Sivan for part of the day. And if you turn to page 5, the top of page 5, two sources, that in Mainz, when do you think they fasted in Mainz? They fasted in Mainz on the third day of Sivan. B'magenza, look at the top of page 5, we have a custom, the basic custom is you don't say Tachnun from Rosh Chodesh Sivan until Shavuos. So I don't know why Tachnun gets such a bad rap, actually, in our community. Oh, Baruch Hashem, there's a bris. Oh, Baruch Hashem, come back tomorrow. I want the mile to daven by me because inevitably I have to skip Tachnun. A whole month of Nissan. What a bracha. What Nebuch. Today, Tuesday, the first day in 5 weeks that we said Tachnun. For a whole month we got off without saying Tachnun. I actually, it's kind of sound a little bit odd. I really resonate. I think Tachnun is deeply meaningful. I try to find, and I hope we all do, try to find meaning in our davening. Now, we shouldn't just, it's not just like saying words, because it's very easy to just say words because we say them all the time. But for me, Tachnun, it deeply resonates. It's very gripping. It's very deep. It's very real. The sentiments expressed in Tachnun. So I actually, I don't know, maybe I'm kind of an oddball. So I mamish miss Tachnun. So I'm a happy guy today because we're back in business. I was able to say Tachnun. But turns out that our minhag is that from Rosh Chodesh Sivan until Shavuos, we don't say Tachnun. Why not? Rosh Chodesh is Rosh Chodesh. And then we have day 3, 4, and 5 is the Shlosh Yemei Hagbola, the 3 days leading up to Shavuos. Then you have Shavuos. And then some people are really excited to give you a whole week after Shavuos because, I don't want to say Tachnun, so I'm going to figure out a way not to say Tachnun. And what about the second day of Sivan? First day is Rosh Chodesh, 3, 4, and 5 is Shlosh Yemei Hagbola. The second day has a special name in our tradition, and it's known as, anybody? Yom HaMeyuchas. Yasher Koach, extra lollipop for you after this year. It's known as Yom HaMeyuchas. Why is it called Yom HaMeyuchas? Nothing happened on it, but it's called the Meyuchas Dikah Day. It actually cuts both of it. One interpretation is, we feel bad for it, so we call it a Yom HaMeyuchas Dafka because nothing happened. So we, and the other is, and one that I like much, much better, is that where does your yichas come from? Your ultimate yichas comes from with whom you associate. See, we think our yichas comes from the Bubis and the Zaydis and the Elder Bubis. What does that have to do with me? Yeah, I understand, the neshama is beautiful, I love it, the Baruch Hashem, I have wonderful Elder Bubis and Zaydis, the Zechusim, it's all great. But for me to be considered a miyuchas, I need to proactively engage in that activity. And I do that by associating myself on this side and on this side with wonderful people. I situate myself in a community of great people. And that's why Yom HaMiyuchas is called Yom HaMiyuchas, is because it's in between Rosh Chodesh and the first of the Shlosh Yisrimei Hagbalah. It dafka draws its yichas from both sides. I like that a lot better than, it's like the opposite. Why do we call Kiddush on Shabbos morning Kedusha Rabbah? Kiddush on Shabbos morning, the Gemara in Pesachim, Kedusha Rabbah. Kedusha Rabbah, you got to be kidding. Friday night, I unload 2 paragraphs, and I'm singing Kivanu V'Charta, and I got a whole thing going. I got the Shabbos morning, what's Kiddush? Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Baruch Pri HaGafen. If I were to right now stop and take a drink of wine, and I'd make the same bracha on a Tuesday night, a Baruch Pri HaGafen. Kedusha Rabbah is called Kedusha Rabbah, says the Mefarshim, because it's not Kedusha Rabbah. Because it's like, that Kedusha is a big Kedusha. This Kedusha, so we're going to call it big Kedusha, so it shouldn't feel so bad. All right, it's very sweet. Yom HaMeyuchas, it's not Yom HaMeyuchas, I'm going to call it Yom HaMeyuchas. I like my interpretation better. What does it have to do with this? Because in Mainz, the custom was that they said Tachnun through the third day. Why did they say Tachnun through the third day? Because the third day in Mainz of Sivan, that's the anniversary. And they fasted on that day. B'magenza, top of page 5, Omrim Techina ad Gimel Sivan. Techina means Slichas, they used to say Tachnun. They used to say Tachnun until Gimel a sivan ki begimel besivan misanin sham bechol shana al gezera shahisa sham ba'osoyo. So it turns out that when the Kina says ein lahosif moed sheva v'saveira, that we don't add days of mourning, and therefore I'm commemorating it today, what they must have been talking about is national mourning, as opposed to local mourning. Local mourning took place. So again, to just strengthen, during this time now in which we are finding ourselves between Pesach and Shavuos, we now have this whole overlay of the Crusades on top of the ancient event dealing with the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, which brings me to my final point, and that is Holocaust commemoration and the State of Israel. Does everybody have a copy of the single page besides the... Okay, so just hold on to it. I'm going to get there shortly. To make a very difficult story very short, after the founding of the State of Israel, it was very difficult for the State of Israel to come to terms with the Holocaust. So roughly in May of 1948, there were roughly 600,000 Jews who were living in the Holy Land, in Eretz Yisrael, which became Medinat Yisrael. Baruch Shechiyanu v'kiyamanu v'giyanu lazman hazeh. Tomorrow night is Yom HaTzmaut. And I don't know if we appreciate enough, and I don't think we could ever appreciate enough, the blessing that we have in our generation and in our time. I was born after the founding of the State of Israel. I can't imagine a Jewish existence anywhere without the State of Israel. Anyone born after the founding of the State of Israel, I think, is in the same category. And we maybe sometimes take it for granted, and it's a terrible mistake. It needs our help in so many different ways. And to appreciate the miracle of Kum Medinat Yisrael, when it was founded, 600,000 Jews, roughly 25% were Holocaust survivors, who somehow, by hook or by crook, and it wasn't easy because of the British blockade and the quotas, made their way to what became the State of Israel. In the early years, it was very difficult for the state to deal with the Holocaust. Those who had been living in Israel during the Holocaust, the members of the old Yishuv, didn't want to have anything to do with it. It was an embarrassment for them. They saw in it the ultimate debasement of the Jewish people. They saw in it an image of a Jew that they were devoting every shred and ounce of their energies to eradicate. They were going to project an image of a Jew who was strong, who was tough, who's going to fight back. And for them, this story represented the passivity of the Jew, and they weren't going to be passive anymore. It was an embarrassment. They didn't want to deal with it. The survivors who made their way also had difficulty dealing with it. There are survivors who in 2012 have difficulty dealing with it, and we should kiss and hug every survivor that we meet and hold on to them. I have a minhag, a personal minhag, that whenever I meet a survivor, I bow my head and I ask them for a bracha. I want you to give me a bracha. I want you to give me a bracha. If I could meet a survivor who puts one foot in front of another and has the most remote relationship to God, I want a blessing from that person. And it was hard for them to deal with it. I don't need to spell it out for you. They were shell-shocked. They were overwhelmed. They were feeling guilty. Why did I survive? Why did my mother and my father and my little brother and sister and cousin and wife and son and daughter, why did they not survive? And nobody wanted to hear their stories anyway. Nobody would have believed their stories. It was horrible. And so there was what I call a conspiracy of silence that was going on in the State of Israel in 1947, 1948, 1949. Nobody really wanted to talk about it, not from this side and not from that side. However, we have in English an expression that's called, there's an elephant in the room. There's an elephant in the room. So, vu megitza chadre, however you're going to want to crawl out of it, you can't crawl out of it. Because the force and the power and the drama and the reality of the Shoah was so great that it was simply impossible to avoid on any level. So Yosef Shprintzak was the speaker of the first Knesset. And Yosef Shprintzak decided that it was not enough, as had been going on, that various Landsmannschaften would have days of memorial, they'd have a service, different kibbutzim were founded by Holocaust survivors, and they would have services. Different shtetlach would get together and find out when the yahrzeit was, Nebuch, when that whole shtetl was liquidated, and they would have a service. It wasn't enough for this individual and that individual in this town and that kibbutz and this Landsmannschaft to have memorial, but it was important for the state of Israel, qua state, to have a memorial to commemorate the Holocaust. And so he appointed Rabbi Mordechai Nurak, who was a member of Mafdal. Mafdal was Miflaga Datit Lumit, what we call Mizrahi, the religious Zionist party, to head a subcommittee. Rabbi Nurak was an observant Jew. He was a rabbi in Latvia, and his wife and two children were killed by the Nazis during the Second World War. He somehow made his way to the State of Israel. He became politically active, as he had been back home. He became a member of Mizrahi. He got himself on the list for the first Knesset, was elected to the first Knesset under Mizrahi. And Shprintzak said, I'm going to ask Rabbi Nurak to do this because I, even though I'm a secular Jew, I understand that in order for this to have meaning in the State of Israel, a national day of commemoration, it's going to have some kind of a traditional hue to it. It's going to be somehow informed by tradition. Yes, I know it's a new state. Yes, I know we have a new way of doing things, but after all, we're not starting de novo. We have a tradition. We need some kind of a traditional overlay for this. And he picked one of the most traditional Jews who were members of Knesset, Rabbi Nur. And there were three other members of the Knesset, and they were all extremely, either ranging from moderate anti-religious or rabidly anti-religious. And we know their names, and we know their backgrounds, and we know who they were. So the committee meets. And on April 12, 1951, the bottom of page 5, Rabbi Nurak shows up on the podium of the Knesset to give a report. I saw this many, many years ago, and it piqued my curiosity, because normally the Divrei Knesset, it's called the Divrei Knesset, is a verbatim transcript of all the words that are said in the Knesset. Normally, and we have many, 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 many growing volumes of the Divrei Knesset. It's like the Congressional Record in America, but it's not like the Congressional Record. Congressional Record in America every day could be a quarter of an inch thick. It would take you a year and a half to read every word on that day's Congressional Record. And the answer is, it's not just everything that's said in the House and the Senate, but a congressperson can give a talk to the local Kiwanis Club and insert it into, you know, 3.5 Vayli Yidinis came to hear him somewhere in Duluth, and he's going to insert that speech into the Congressional Record. So any member of Congress, House or Senate, could put anything they want into the Congressional Record. The Divrei Knesset is mamish only literally the words that are said in the Knesset. And when you open it up, it's the name of the person, parenthesis, party affiliation, and parenthesis, then there's a colon, and then it's what he said. Here, Shprintzak introduces Nurak as the Yoshev Rosh Vaadat HaMishneh Shel Vaadat HaKnesset, the chairman of the subcommittee of the Knesset, and Nurak is introduced right after his name, B'Shem Vaadat HaKnesset. So I was very interested in this unfolding of Holocaust commemoration. I'm very interested academically. I teach a course at Yeshiva University. It's called Commemorating Communal Catastrophe. It's a memory course. Memory is very in the academy today. Memory studies, and not just individual memory, but particularly cultural memory. How do cultures remember events that happened that they want to transmit to the next generation? And it could be a happy thing, it could be a sad thing, it could be anything that the culture considers to be a value that it wants the next generation to remember. So I'm very interested in this, and I want to know what the Vaadat HaKnesset is. So I went looking in the archives of the Knesset. So, you know how it works in Israel. So I found somebody whose brother-in-law was a shaliach in New Zealand with a guy who's chavrusa in Gush, had a makolet, who had somebody in his makolet whose sister-in-law's divorced mother-in-law's neighbor had a cousin who once went to the United States to visit somebody and bumped on the street to somebody who happened to be somebody who knew the brother-in-law of the cousin of the sister of the neighbor of somebody who worked in the archives of the Knesset. And it wasn't that off, actually, for me to get into the archives of the Knesset. So I get into the archives of the Knesset, and I tell the archivist, I'm interested in the backstory. I'm interested in the Va'adat HaKnesset. So she brings me out a whole bunch of paper, and it's old, and it's yellowed, and it's all the samachs and the peis are pushed through and falling out. It's old typewritten. And I start to read, and I Xerox the part of it on the single page. And the question is, when should Yom HaShoah be? When should we commemorate Holocaust Memorial Day? And you understand what the issue is. The issue is, I understand why we commemorate Tisha B'Av and Tisha B'Av. Why do we fast on Tisha B'Av? Because what are we fasting for on Tisha B'Av, primarily? We're fasting because the temple was destroyed on Tisha B'Av. As a matter of fact, both temples were destroyed on Tisha B'Av. So if the Gemara, the Mishnah says five things happened on Tisha B'Av, and two of them were the destructions of the Beis HaMikdash, and it happened on that day, and that's what I want to commemorate, so on that day I'm going to fast. What am I going to do if I want to commemorate an event that happened for 6 years? Happened for 6.5 years. Start when you want to start. It didn't happen just on one day. It happened for a long time. So, Vasepis, why is this day a better day, a more appropriate day to commemorate than that day? So how am I going to figure out what methodology am I going to use to try to determine which day? And so there was a debate, as I discover on the single page that I gave you. So Nurek is reporting now on March 13th. This is the old typewritten sheet that I found, and number of sheets that I found in the archives. He says, we had a discussion, we all decided that we have to have one day to commemorate. And Lo Banu, the end of the third line where it says Nurek in the second section, after the underlined, Lo Banu Li Dei Haskem Bidvar HaTarich. We decided we need a day. That's what we do. We do days. When we want to remember in our tradition, we do days. But we couldn't figure out which day. Lo banu lidei eskem bedvar ha-tarech v'hutzu shalosh hatzaot. There were three suggestions. Aleph, shel chaver ha-knesset Aleph Aharon Tzizling likboa et hayom be'erev Pesach. Erev Pesach. What happened on Erev Pesach? Why Erev Pesach? Because what's the day called? What's the day called on the top of the page? Yom Meret Agitot. What's it called today in 2012 after the law in 1959? Yom HaShoah VeHaGevurah. In the first iteration, it was not Shoah and it was not Gevurah. It was Yom Meret Agitot. When is Behei HaYidiyah HaMered HaGetto, the Warsaw Ghetto? When did the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising start? Erev Pesach. Erev Pesach, 14th of Nisan. Says Tzizling, if this is a Yom Meret Agitaot, so we're going to do it. I know it lasted 5-6 weeks. What day should I choose? Logical, I'll choose the day it started. Yesterday there was no ghetto uprising. Today there is a ghetto uprising. Today it started. Today is the day. Erev Pesach. Shel Chaverat HaKnesset Raziel Naor, B'yom Protz Milchemet Ha'ula. I don't think I should do it on Erev Pesach. I should do it on the Hebrew equivalent of September 1st, 1939. I should do it on the day that World War II broke out. If I'm doing already the beginning, the first, so I should do it in the first. The first I consider to be September 1st, 1939. Vani tzati, says Nurak, et yom asar b'teves. And there's a long history. The chief rabbinate of Israel already a couple of years earlier, 1947, established what they call Yom HaKadish HaKlali, a day, Nebuch, for somebody who wants to say Kaddish for a loved one, doesn't know the day that they were killed, doesn't know. And I can't live with that. I want to remember them. I want to memorialize them. I want to say Kaddish for them. When should I say Kaddish for them? Chief Rabbinate said, Asara B'teves. So Nurek says we should make Yom HaKadish HaKlali and transform it not only into a ritual expression of mourning and grief from a traditionalist point of view, but that should become the Yom HaShoah. And then follows the next concluding paragraph. Nurak here in the middle says to Tzizling, my dear beloved Tzizling, are you out of your mind? Are you out of your mind? Tzizling said, when? Erev Pesach. He says, Erev Pesach? I'm going to have a Yom HaShoah, a Yom Eretz. I'm going to have Holocaust Commemoration Day, Erev Pesach. Like last night, Bedikas Chametz, and today is and tonight, it's, so Tzizling answers. And if you wouldn't have it in front of you, you wouldn't believe it. And you'll see why I'm telling you all this. Ein anu matziyim, four lines from the bottom, underline. Tzizling says, you know what, Rabbi Nurak? I respect you. I love you. You're an amazing person. You're right. Okay. Ein anu matziyim likboa yom kavua b'chodesh. I don't think it really needs to be on a 14th. You're offended by the 14th? Okay. Doesn't have to be on a particular day of the month. Ela likboa yom b'chodesh Nisan. As long as it's in the month of Nisan, which, by the way, Rabbi Nurak pushed for it not to be, because Chodesh Nisan is Chodesh HaGeula. Guess what? We don't say Tachnun during Chodesh Nisan. So he just sizzling wanted on a Chodesh Nisan. You don't want it on the 14th? Ein zeh, listen to this. Chayav lihiyot dafka erev Pesach mamash. Ze yachol lihiyot yom lifnei zeh. O acharei zeh. Okay. No problem. You don't want to have it on Erev Pesach? Could be the day before Erev Pesach. Could be the day after Erev Pesach. It's okay with me. It's obviously not a woman. Obviously not a lot of things. So last I checked, the day after Erev Pesach is Pesach. And for Tzizling, it did not matter one whit and one iota. We today, correctly so, are really caught up in and disturbed by and upset by and struggle with what I would call the Kulturkampf, the cultural battles, the culture wars in Israel. The traditionalist, the non-traditionalist, the anti-traditionalist. And they want to now have buses running in Tel Aviv on Shabbos and questioning all kinds of givens in the fabric of religious life in Israel that have always been part of the civic religion of Israel. And here at the very beginning, what we're seeing today is Gunish mit Gunish. It pales compared to this conversation that took place with five people in a room with one typist banging away like this on old yellow paper, which is why we know about it, because it's left. We have it. One second. It could be the day after Pesach. And for him, it wasn't an issue, because Pesach, Erev Pesach, the day after Erev Pesach, it didn't matter. Now, they go back and forth. I only stopped this in the middle. They go back and forth. And at the end, where do they land? When is Yom HaShoah? Yom HaShoah is on Chaf Zayin Nisan. Chaf Zayin Nisan. Let's go back now to the bottom of page 5, and with this I conclude. Rabbi Nurek is explaining why Yom HaShoah is during this time of the year. He does not in this text explain the specific choice of Chaf Zayin Nisan, but he explains the time of year, and he gives a number of rationales. Anu tzrichim livchor, we're now all the way at the bottom of page 5, final text. Anu tzrichim livchor b'ta'arich muvhak. We have to choose a particular date. Hamatim gam lizman rov hashchitot Shel Yahadut Europa. Number one, he says, if you take a graph and you plot the graph, 1939, 40, 41 till 45, and you plot across spring, summer, fall, winter, and you put into the graph the number of Jews who were killed in each one of those sections, you will find that more Jews were killed in the springtime than any other season of the year. And it makes sense. In the fall it was getting cold, in the winter it was too cold, in the summer it was too hot. In the springtime, we're now beginning to crawl out from winter, we get the machinery going, and Nebuch, more Jews are killed. So if you want to choose a time of year when to commemorate the Holocaust, choose a time of year when most Jews were killed. That's number one. Number two, ulemered hagita'ot shehitkayem b'chodesh Nisan. Number two, notice what it's called here. What's it called here in April of 1951? Yom HaShoah Umered Hagita'ot. What happened? What did it used to be called? Yom Mered Hagita'ot. Now it became Yom HaShoah Umered Hagita'ot. If Mered Hagita'ot is something significant, then we have to do it during the time of year when the Mered Hageto took place, which is in the month of Nisan. Umishum kachan, therefore, b'chara v'adat ha-kneset b'sof chodesh Nisan. Therefore, we chose at the end of the month of Nisan. Why did we choose the end of the month of Nisan? B'yemei ha-sfira. We wanted it to fall during the sfira time. What happened during the sfira time? Shebahem, on those days, hushmedu al yedei avot avotehem shel hanatzim, there were killed by the ancestors of the Nazis. Who were the ancestors of the Nazis? Anshei Mas'ei HaTzlav. Tzlav means cross. Mas'ei HaTzlav are the crusaders. Kihilot Kedoshot Rebbe. And so our final iteration is that Yom HaShoah is explicitly identified as having been chosen in a time of year, in a very limited time of year, that has everything to do not only with the fact that most Jews were killed during that little tiny time of year, not just with the fact that the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising took place during that time of year, but in order to connect this event with the historical precedent of the Crusades, which happened this time of year. And so we have this overview, starting with Rabbi Akiva in the very early history, moving to the Middle Ages, the early Middle Ages, the Crusades, and then finding its final iteration in our time in the debate over and conclusion drawn to determine the date of Yom HaShoah. Yom HaShoah was last week, and tomorrow night, and Thursday is Yom HaAtzma'ut. It is our prayer that the state of Israel should continue to be stronger and stronger, should it be able to withstand all of its tensions, and that whereas we unfortunately have a past that needs to be commemorated and remembered, as we look forward, we should look forward only to joyous occasions, to simchas in our families, and for the entire Jewish people. Wish all of you a Chag Sameach for tomorrow night, and thank you for coming. Are you taking 5 minutes because I'm like totally frozen? Okay.
Rabbi Schachter is happy to take some private questions. We have refreshments set up in the atrium with tea and milchik pastries on the right and par pastries on the left. In 5 minutes from now, it's right now 9:24, let's say 9:30, we'll be convening a Mariv downstairs in our base medrash. Thank you very much, Rabbi Schachter. Thank you all for coming.